It was 8:12 p.m. on December 6, 2014, and Cole Haley was responding to the call of a car fire in Cortland, Mississippi, where he held the role as fire chief at the Cortland Fire Department. It was a surprisingly busy night in the small rural community in Cortland, Mississippi, population of just 512. Cole and his team had just returned to the fire station after having responded to a call of smoke in a house when the car fire call came through. Cole cleaned up at the station before heading out in Engine 81. Two of his firefighters had already arrived at the scene on Heron Road, about a mile and a half away, when he arrived. As he was pulling up to the burning vehicle, he realized that the call they were responding to was perhaps much more than just a car fire. He saw a woman standing in the road, wearing nothing but panties. He jumped out of the truck and immediately went to grab a blanket from the back. The woman started walking towards him, her arms outstretched in front of her, saying, "Help me, help me, help me." Here's Cole describing what he saw that night at a trial that recently took place this past October.
What did she look like? What was the condition of Jessica Chambers?
Her hair was her hair was fried out like she'd stuck it in a light socket. And she had black all over her face. Her body was severely burned. And just all the way down her body was very badly burned. And like I said, and I wrapped the blanket around her to conceal her. I always knew that, learned that, you know, burn victims would be cold. And so that's why, you know, I placed the blanket around her and we proceeded to walk up the road. I was trying to get her to the front of the Engine 81 to where the headlights were, where it'd be more light, where, you know, could access her a little more, you know, see a little better. We made it to the back of Engine 81 and she couldn't go anymore. And I proceeded to lay her down on the ground. She reached out for my hand. I held on to her hand and I talked to her and I asked her name. And she said, "What come out?" Like I said, her mouth, inside her mouth was just charred black and could not understand her very well at all.
Were you able to get a name?
When I asked her name, she said, "Jessica Chambers."
The woman tried telling him her name, which was Jessica Chambers, only it came out sounding like Jessica Chambers. He said her voice was garbled and dry. He was face to face with her, and yet he could barely understand what she was saying. He said he knew Jessica from the neighborhood and recognized her car, but she was nearly unrecognizable. He held her hand and asked what had happened to her. She managed to get out that she had been set on fire. He asked who did this to her. She tried to say a name, but he couldn't understand what she was trying to say. She started fading in and out, her eyes closing and her head rolling back. Cole kept saying, "Jessica, sweetheart, help's coming," to try and keep her alert. By that time, other firefighters and paramedics had arrived at the scene. It was becoming chaotic. He heard some of the other firefighters ask Jessica who did this to her, and although he couldn't make out her answer to them either, many of them said they heard what she said, that it sounded like she was saying the name Eric. Jessica was airlifted to the burn unit at Regional Medical Center in Memphis, Tennessee, about 50 miles away, But once she arrived, it was clear to the doctors in the unit that Jessica wouldn't be able to survive her injuries. Within 3 hours of her arrival, Jessica passed away. News of Jessica's death spread through the small town of Cortland and the surrounding areas. Jessica was 19 years old and had been a well-liked, popular cheerleader, having just graduated from South Panola High School. She was one of 8 children born to Ben and Lisa Chambers, and she worked in sales at the Goodies department store in nearby Batesville, Mississippi. Word quickly spread that Jessica's death wasn't an accident. It had been deliberate. But who would have wanted to kill this vivacious, friendly 19-year-old with her whole life ahead of her? Today, I'm going to take you into the case of Jessica Chambers. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 41. Two years went by before there was an arrest in the case. 2 years of small-town rumors, baseless accusations, and rampant speculations. 2 years of a family not knowing what exactly happened to their beloved daughter and why. And the members of the Chambers family were no strangers to tragedy and heartbreak. Just 2 years prior to Jessica's death, her older brother Ben, just 28 years old, had been killed in a car accident. Shortly after her murder, investigators released surveillance photos from a nearby gas station from 5:30 p.m. the night she was killed. They were the last known photos of an alive Jessica Chambers. Just 2.5 hours later, a passing motorist would call 911 to report a car fire on the side of the road. Finally, in February 2016, a man who was already in jail, suspected of murdering a university exchange student in 2015, was indicted in Jessica's murder. 27-year-old Quentin Tellis was charged with capital murder, which, in Mississippi, is used when a death has occurred during the commission of a felony, in this case, third-degree arson. Quentin was originally from Cortland, Mississippi, the same town as Jessica, and they were reportedly friends. Here's District Attorney John Champion at a news conference announcing the arrest.
Quentin Tellis is or was a suspect fairly early in this case. We continued to work on this case for quite a long time. We developed evidence in the fall that really led us to focus pretty seriously on him. We went forward on the evidence, continued working on the evidence up until we had a meeting at the with some other prosecutors. I actually brought some other prosecutors in and presented our case to them to let them give us critique, see what they thought about the case. We got very positive feedback from them. We then made the decision as a team to go forward and present the case to the grand jury, which is what we did over the last 2 days.
If it seems like he's being careful in explaining their rationale for the charges, that might be because a community of internet sleuths who had been following the case since day one were immediately skeptical that Quentin Tellis was the killer. Many of them believed that Jessica's death was drug or gang-related and that there were multiple people involved, not just one person. And then, even though this information hadn't been officially released yet to the public, there was the fact that numerous first responders had reported that Jessica had named her killer, Eric, or even Derek, which, arguably, sounds nothing like Quentin. But even with the ongoing outside rumors, the trial for Quentin Tellis would begin in October 2017. District Attorney John Champion gave the opening statement for the prosecution. He began by describing Jessica and where she was in her life at the time of the murder. He said just 2 weeks prior to her death, Jessica met a man who would end her life and who would change the course of her family and friends and everyone that knew her. That man was Quentin Tellis. He told the court that Jessica, Quentin, and Jessica's friend, Keisha Myers, all hung out on the morning of her death. And then later, she hung out with Quentin again. He said cell phone data shows that Quentin and Jessica were at an area just south of Quentin's house, beginning around 6:30 p.m. that night. Champion described where Quentin lived, right across the street from a gas station and convenience store called M&M. The surveillance cameras from M&M not only show inside of the convenience store and the gas station lot, but they also show Quentin's driveway and the road Quentin's house is on. At 7:26 p.m., Champion said a set of headlights can be seen on the surveillance video, leaving the drive just south of Quentin's home and heading south on Highway 51. At the exact same time, Jessica's phone moves in that same direction. He said at 8:06 p.m., a phone call is made from a man named Glenn Williams to the Panola County Sheriff's Department, reporting a car on fire near the side of the road. Jessica's car was found in an embankment between a fence and a tree. Champion conceded that while first responders were tending to Jessica, they tried to talk to her and ask who had done this to her. He said they got a variety of responses, but the most common take was that it sounded like she had said Eric or Derek, not Quentin's name. "But please do not make a judgment at this point," Champion said. "The evidence will change your mind. I promise you that." One piece of evidence would come in the form of location data from Jessica and Quentin's phones. Champion said that in October 2015, an analyst from the U.S. Attorney's Office started looking into the cell phone data and realized that the location data that they were getting from the cell phone company wasn't quite accurate. He said they used different software and compared that to the places they knew Jessica had been that day, either confirmed by video or eyewitnesses. And that's when they learned just how off it was. And when they used that same software on Quentin's phone, it showed their phones were right on top of each other. He said investigators made the decision to reapproach Quentin. They had questioned him early on in the investigation, but hadn't looked at him in a while. Quentin was now married and was living in Monroe, Louisiana. They questioned him again and confronted him with their new cell phone evidence. Champion said Quentin changed his story to match their evidence they presented. "The state is not required to prove a motive," Champion told the jury, "but you can develop your own motive." He pointed out that there were a series of text messages from Quentin to Jessica, including on the day she died, where he asks her for sex. And he reminded them that all she was wearing when first responders found her was a pair of panties on December 6th in the cold weather. Champion outlined the prosecution's theory. Quentin suffocated Jessica and thought that he had killed her, so he had to get her away from his house. He drove to the scene where Jessica was eventually found, parked the car, took the keys with him, and ran towards his sister's house about a mile away. As he was running, he either dropped the keys or threw them. "His DNA is on those keys," Champion told the jurors. He then ran to his sister's house and borrowed his sister's car. Surveillance video shows headlights near a shed on Quentin's property, a shed in which Quentin later admitted to police he housed a gas can with gasoline in it. Quentin then drove back to the scene, poured gasoline into Jessica's car, lit it up, and then drove to nearby Batesville so he'd have an alibi. He asked the jury to find Quentin guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In her opening statement, Quentin's attorney, Darla Palmer, told the jury that the evidence will show that this indeed was a horrible crime, a terrible thing that happened to Jessica Chambers that day, 3 years ago. But evidence will show that Jessica repeatedly talked to the first responders and told them what her name was, and the fact that, quote, "Eric set me on fire. Eric did this to me." Darla said that nothing the state will present to you will change your mind once you hear from the responders who were out there. She said Jessica didn't know Eric's last name, but that she knew Quentin Tellis's full name, yet didn't say it. She said the cell phone records are not reliable and that you cannot pinpoint an exact location. And as for the video footage from the store across the street from Quentin's house, you can only see headlights, she pointed out. She said Quentin had an alibi too, He had gone to get a prepaid card for his girlfriend. She said records found by the state during the very time frame that Quinton was supposed to have been committing this crime, he was actually in the store in Batesville, purchasing the card. This case is full of reasonable doubt, she said. We can't ignore that Jessica did not say Quinton's name. Eric is not on trial today, but he should be. She asked the jury to find Quinton not guilty. Jessica's mom was one of the first witnesses to take the stand. She recounted the last time she saw Jessica for the jury. She said on Saturday, December 6, 2014, when Jessica got home in the afternoon, she took a nap. She woke up sometime later after receiving a phone call or text from someone. Jessica told her that she was going to get something to eat and then clean out her car. That was at about 5:15 p.m. and was the last time she saw her. She said she spoke to Jessica on the phone at 6:48 p.m. She said that looking back on the call, she realized that it was strange not to hear any background noise when she talked to her. Typically, she would hear music or the wind from the windows being down in Jessica's car. But this time, there was nothing, which now makes her think that someone else was with her. Later that night, Jessica's stepmom came over to her house, and she was told that Jessica had been set on fire. She said she was able to reach Jessica at the medical center and was able to say a final goodbye to her daughter. One of Jessica's best friends, Keisha Myers, took the stand and said that she and Jessica lived by each other and hung out a lot. On Saturday, December 6th, Jessica picked her up around 10 a.m. from her boyfriend's house. She said Quinton Tellis was with her. She said they usually just rode around in the car when they hung out, and so that's what they did for about an hour or two. She recalled that they drove by the spot where Jessica was burned twice that day. They then dropped Quinton off, and then Jessica dropped her off, saying that she would hit her up again later. But Keisha ran out of minutes, so her cell phone was off, and she didn't talk to her again. Keisha told the jury that her birthday was the next day, and later, she found out that Jessica had been planning on taking her to Memphis that night to celebrate. She found out the day after Jessica's death that she had died. She said it was hard to believe because she had just seen her. She then described an incident that had occurred a couple days prior to Jessica's death, when she was again riding around with Jessica and Quinton. They were dropping Quinton off at an area in town known as the Sandbox. She said both Jessica and Quinton got out of the car.
And as Jessica got out, did Quinton approach her?
They were conversating as they were already talking before they got out of the car, but they got out of the car and they were still having their conversation. And they just gave it, he wanted a hug, they got a hug, exchanged a hug, and then he left them walk off from there.
But something about the hug,
it just wasn't sitting right, you know, because the way Jessica acted, she acted like it was, you know, something dangerous. Like she acted like she was paranoid or scared of something. I don't know what it could have been. But she made it seem like it was, like, you know, aggressive towards her. But
did she appear to be returning the, I guess for lack of a better word, returning the love?
She made it like short, made it like, you know, a friendly hug. But she made it seem more of like she was scared to do it. So she made it a quick hug and then got back in the car and he left.
And this occurred at the Sandbox?
Yes.
Okay. The next witness was Glenn Williams. He testified that he and his friend Troy were heading down Heron Road on the night of December 6, 2014, when they came across a car on fire. He said the fire had spread up into the trees. They drove past the car a little bit and then pulled over and got out. He didn't see anyone, but said that his initial thought was that someone had started the car on fire for an insurance payout. They called the Cortland Fire Department and reported it. Cole Haley, the fire chief at the Cortland Fire Department, took the stand and recounted for the jury responding to the car on fire call. Although he said he never heard her say the name Eric, the other firefighters did and told him that that's what she said. And when Cole says that others heard her say the name Eric, he means that at least 9 other first responders, who all testified to it, had heard the name Eric. Jody Morris was one of them. He described Jessica as looking like a zombie because of her singed hair and the way she was walking. He said they got Jessica to lie on the ground, and then he started talking to her.
Did you eventually learn who it was?
Yes.
And when did you eventually learn who it was?
When I started questioning.
And what did you say to her?
Well, my first question I asked her, I said, what's your name? And she told me, my name's Jessica Chambers.
And then?
And then my second question was, I said, was anybody else in the vehicle with you? And she said, no. And then I said, well, what happened? I said, Jessica, what happened to you? Because at that time, I recognized who she was. While I was questioning her, I was steady looking at her body, you know, examining the extent of her injuries. And she told me, she said, Eric set me on fire.
And tell the jury, what were the extent of her injuries?
Her lips were charred, her tongue was charred. I mean, you can obviously tell it was third degree burns in her face. Her nasal, sinus cavities were even hanging out of her nose.
That's what I'm getting at. So when you observed her, tell the jury about her nose.
I mean, she was having problems breathing. I mean, that was because of it. I mean, it was all charred, black, all in her nose. Like she just inhaled all the fire in her face.
What about her lips?
Her lips were black. I mean, it's like it was just dried up.
Were the two of you talking like you and I are talking right now?
No.
And what do you mean by that?
She was having problems breathing the time I got back back behind the fire truck. I mean, she was having problems breathing. Her voice was deeper than mine is. But I can make out what she was saying.
Daniel Cole was the director of emergency operations in Cortland, who also responded to the scene and described talking to Jessica.
Did you attempt to speak to her?
I did.
What type of information did you attempt to obtain?
Tried to obtain who she was.
And how did she respond when you asked who she was?
It took multiple attempts, but we got Jessica. We didn't start with Jessica. At one time, to me, it sounded like Katina, Katrina, Courtney. It was a very chaotic scene. There was a lot of noise. She wasn't speaking very loudly. At one point, even laid down beside her just to get close enough to her to try to hear some of the things, questions. And, some things she said was clearer than others.
I'm going to ask you about the noise. What type of noise was it?
Oh, you had the fire truck, two fire trucks, the diesel engines off two fire trucks, the firemen running around, talking to each other, people, additional responders coming in. It was just a madhouse there for some time.
I've never actually made a fire scene, I'll tell you. What type of noise are we talking about with these fire engines?
I mean, they're diesel engines. I mean, one's a one-ton diesel pickup, and the other's a fire truck with a big diesel engine in it.
And how close were they parked to Jessica Chambers?
Within feet. I mean, we were right at the back of the Cortland's pumper.
As you talked to Jessica, did you know that something was wrong on that scene?
To be honest with you, when I got there and saw her, once we established who she was, I asked her, I said, I don't even know if I asked her what happened. I think I just asked her, who did this?
And?
Or what happened, maybe that's what I asked.
Was she still speaking in the same manner you described before?
Yes, yeah, so she had, the more questions we asked, she would start out strong, and then it would get extremely breathy, very difficult to understand.
Now, you did write a statement, and in your statement, you were able to obtain some information from her. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me what you heard and how you heard it.
We got her name, finally, and we then, who did this? It took multiple attempts, but I did hear Eric did this to me. Eric set me on fire. That's what I heard.
Seven other first responders described what they heard from Jessica as well.
I asked her, I said, baby girl, you know, who done this to you?
Did she respond?
Yes, sir.
What did she say?
She said, Eric.
Tell the jury, describe her voice for the jury.
Well, you couldn't hardly hear her. I mean, you got so much noise going around and you're asking her questions and she's trying her best to answer you.
And you just stated that you asked her name.
I asked her name.
Tell me how you heard her response and how loud was it?
Well, the second time I asked her, what is your name? I had to bend down real low, turn my head, and I heard her say, Jesse. So I jumped up and I looked at Brandy. I said, Brandy, Jesse, Jessica. And somebody from the crowd over on my left hollered, Jessica Chambers. So I looked at her and I said, is your name Jessica Chambers? And she shook her head, yes.
Was Brandy trying to ask any other questions?
Well, he asked, I heard him asking her, who did this to you?
Did you ask that question to her?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I kept saying, I said, who did this to you? I said, honey, I bent down. I said, honey, who did this to you? And all I heard was Eric.
Once it was kind of to my realization that this wasn't an accident, I was asking her, you know, I was trying to ask her name. She was kind of repeating more that I'm cold is mainly the main response I got. I asked her, who done this to you? The response I got was what sounded to be a Eric or a Derek sound to it. Like I said, with her mouth and sucking in the heated air and stuff, she was kind of hard to understand.
When you got there, Jessica was on the ground, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And did you hear people asking her who did this to you?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and did you hear her give a response?
From what I could hear, it sounded like she said Eric. Now, the burns to her face and her body, it was hard to understand, you know, what exactly she was saying.
But it sounded to you like Eric, is
yes,
that correct?
Sir.
Ultimately, I believe Josh put in his report, and you thought you heard a name, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what name did you believe you heard?
Eric.
Okay, do you remember anybody asking her who did this to you?
Yes, several people asked her that.
Okay, and do you remember any response that she might have had?
She said Eric, or tried to say Eric or Derek or something to that effect. With those souls.
When you got in the ambulance and you asked her what was going on or who did this to you, did she respond?
Yes, sir.
And what did you hear?
She said, I asked her who did this to you, and she said, Eric.
And aside from the name Eric, Jessica seemed to give a bit more information to Chuck Tucker, a deputy with the Panola County Sheriff's Department. He testified that he went down to the helicopter landing zone and went inside the ambulance. He said he knew Jessica since she was a baby, as well as her father, who worked as a mechanic at the sheriff's department. He said it was nerve-wracking to see her like that. She had skin hanging all over, and quote, it was bad.
And did you begin to talk to Jessica?
Yes, I did.
And what did you ask her?
I asked her who did this, and she said Eric.
Okay. Describe for the jury how loud or low her voice was.
Well, she was real mumbled and very low, and she couldn't say, you know, a whole lot, but, I mean, she told me that, and I asked her, Eric who, and she said she didn't know.
Okay.
And I had asked her if she knew who I was, and she told me yes.
Okay. And did you ask her any other questions?
Well, I had got out of the ambulance because the sheriff had called my phone and talked to the sheriff for a minute. And then the sheriff told me to find out if he was black or white. So I got back in the ambulance and asked her if he was black or white, and she said black.
Okay.
And perhaps in what would be another point for the defense, two witnesses also testified that they noticed a suspicious person at the scene when they arrived. Brandy Davis, a volunteer firefighter, said he obtained the tag number from this person's car and gave it to his boss. And another firefighter, Will Turner, described the suspicious person to the jury.
You also saw somebody there at the scene that concerned you. Is that correct?
I did.
Tell the jury about that.
This was after the chaoticness had kind of settled down a little bit. I was standing between the Pope's rescue truck and our engine, Engine 81, and a middle-aged black male walked up, and I told him, I said, hey, man, you can't be here. This is a crime scene. You need to leave. He never said a word to me. He gave me a stare that I've never seen before. He stared straight through me. I told him again, I said, hey, man, I need you to leave. This is a crime scene. If you don't leave, I'll get a deputy to escort you out of here. Never said a word, just blank stared through me. He was looking towards where the car was at and in the woods the whole time. He turned around, he began walking off and looking over his shoulder back to where the car was at. He had a blue shirt on, and by the time he got out of my sight, he had a white t-shirt on.
We'll get into the police investigation testimony right after this quick break from our sponsor. Fancy yourself some real detective work? Try your hand with Dispatch, an interactive mystery story that really, and literally, delivers. Each month, you'll receive a box of clues to decipher. And I have to say, these snippets are more richly detailed than a plain old case file. News clippings, journal entries, secret websites, it's fully immersive. And as the story develops month over month, you'll be able to take part, unraveling clues and crime solving alongside the detectives. My fiancé and I got our first couple boxes, and we were completely enamored with it this past Friday night. Dispatch is brought to you by the creators of Breakout Games, the largest creator of escape rooms in the country. It's perfect for lovers of mystery, crime stories, and games, so you can bring the experience home. It really is the whole package, and it's the most engaging format for at-home investigation. You already love listening to a good crime story. Now, you can become part of one. And I have a great deal for you guys. Take 50% off your first delivery with code COURT. That's 50% off. You can find this special deal just for Court Junkie listeners at breakoutdispatch.com/court. That's breakoutdispatch.com/court. And now, back to the episode. A lieutenant of investigations with the Panola County Sheriff's Department, Edward Gleason, described to the court what he saw when he responded to the scene. He said Jessica's vehicle was completely burned, and he did a walkthrough of the area, looking for evidence. He said there was a cell phone about 2.5 feet from the driver's side door on the ground. The back of the cell phone had been taken out, and the phone was divided into two pieces. He said he learned afterwards that the phone was Jessica's. They also recovered a piece of burnt clothing from the scene. Jessica's car was removed and taken to the Panola County Sheriff's Department, and photos of the car were shown to the jury. The passenger side seat was in the reclined position. A man named Jerry Lee King, who lived near the crime scene, took the stand and testified that he was walking with his 1-year-old daughter in a stroller just down the street from where the fire had taken place. He saw a pink rope in a ditch about 5 feet from the road that was attached to something shiny. He said that they were a set of keys, and so he picked them up and handed them to his daughter. When he got home, he showed the keys to his girlfriend. She noticed that there was a tag on them that had the name Ben Chambers, and so they immediately called the sheriff's department. He said when deputies came to pick up the keys, they took DNA samples from him, his daughter, and his girlfriend. Jerry said he then showed the deputies where he had found them. The next couple witnesses testified about Jessica's condition after she was burned. Mary Beth Hall, a nurse practitioner at the burn unit, testified that they were able to ventilate her when she arrived at the hospital, but that her status was critical. She was moving, but wasn't able to follow commands. Hall said the doctors discussed her condition and determined that it was not a survivable injury, given the depths of her burns. She testified that it appeared as though Jessica hadn't been able to get away from the fire. The burns were so deep. She surmised that she was either unaware that she had been burned or was in a place she couldn't get out of. She said they went to speak with Jessica's family to let them know she wouldn't survive and then started comfort care, where they put her on morphine until she passed away. Dr. Aaron Barnhart, the deputy chief medical examiner for the state of Mississippi, performed Jessica's autopsy. She said she didn't observe any sexual trauma and noted that there was no evidence that Jessica had been on her period, something that will come up a little later in the trial. Jessica had third-degree burns on her face, scalp, neck, chest, and back, second and third-degree burns on her arms, and second-degree burns on her legs. The areas of Jessica's body that were not burned were her groin, rear, back of her upper thighs, and bottoms of her feet. But about 93% of her body was burned. Dr. Barnhart told the jury that the cause of death was soot and smoke inhalation and thermal injuries, and the manner of death was homicide. Dr. William Hickerson, the medical director at the Burn Center, testified that Jessica was likely in a sitting position when she was burned due to the sparing of the burns on the backs of her legs and butt. He said this was one of the worst burn cases you'll see and that it wasn't a quick burn. He said you have to have a high temperature and a longer exposure to get that type of injury, which was consistent with sitting in a car or an enclosed area. Prosecutor Champion asked him about the zombie-like state the paramedics testified that Jessica was in.
We had one of the first responders refer to her as a zombie. And when he referred to how she was walking. Would that be consistent with the injuries that you found?
Yes, sir. Remember, we talked about the fact that skin is now like leather. And so you can't move it like you normally would. And the face itself, I think that when you look at that, the facial expressions are gone. She's not able to make any facial expressions because that skin is tight. In addition, you've got the tongue that's there that has been injured. So all of that comes into play, particularly along with the swelling that she could have in her mouth as well.
Champion also asked how the injuries would have affected her speech.
And doctor, starting with her lips and her mouth, would you describe to the jury aspects here that could severely affect her speech?
Sure. When we speak, one of the main things that we do is we move our mouth. We change the position of our lips. We change the position of our tongue, whether it goes up, whether it goes out, whatever we do with that or how it goes back up to the roof in the back to be able to speak. This isn't going to move. This is going to be more like the Downs child that I've talked about. But the tongue, that can't move. And when you combine everything, particularly with the swelling, it's almost like my voice now, okay, with colds or allergies, we get a lot of swelling back there in the back of the throat. That big thing that hangs down, the uvula gets longer. You know, you just can't make things sound like you normally would. If you're a singer, try going to the choir and hitting those notes that you normally would. It just doesn't happen. And that's why a lot of singers use a lot of steroids to keep that edema down. In this case, you've got the lips that don't move, the tongue that's not going to work right. It's thicker. It's in the back. You cannot enunciate any of those words that you would want to say. It just doesn't come out right.
In regards to her airway itself, there was testimony from Dr. Barnhart that her airway was generally more red than it should be, and she actually referred to those as heat injuries. Is that the type of injury you would expect in a case like this?
I would describe those as being more chemical injuries, sir. Heat is a little more difficult below our airways, but can occur. And not having done the autopsy and not having seen the specimen, if it were truly heat, then this was, an extremely hot temperature.
And the chemicals you're referring to, are those byproducts of combustion inside that car?
Yes, sir.
Now, explain to the jury what edema or edema to the throat would be.
That's just the swelling. It's the swelling that occurs because of those chemicals, because of the steam that's there, that you're going to have. It's the body's reaction to that type of injury.
And could edema or swelling to the throat cause difficulty with speech?
Without a doubt.
Finally, you mentioned the chest being tight, and certainly we see the cuts and how the pressure had to be released, the easiest way I could put it. But The chest being tight itself on the scene as was described, could that affect her speech?
Yes, sir, because what you have to do to be able to speak is get air out of your lungs. If you have less air going in, you're not going to have as much getting out. If you're going to yell at somebody, what do? Take a deep breath, and then you shout at your kid to get back in here. Okay? Likewise, when you're going to talk and you're excited, you're trying to do that, that's not going to come out right because she just does not have the amount of air to be able to get that accomplished.
So given the injuries that you described in detail for this jury to her lips and her mouth, also to her tongue, with possible edema and the tightness of the chest, is it likely that she would have severe difficulties in her speech?
Yes, sir, without a doubt.
On cross-examination, Quinton's attorney was quick to point out that Jessica's condition likely worsened by the time she got down to the burn center from when she was originally found.
Just with regard to the tongue, if there's a time frame of 2 hours passage, I would imagine that there was a worsening or she was in a worse condition than she was in 2 hours before that.
Okay.
Is that a yes?
That's a yes, but it's a yes that states, I still think that what I stated on the front end in regards to her airway and her speech would still be paramount and give her problems with any type of communication.
Correct. She could still speak, though. You agree with that?
She could probably still speak.
Yes.
Just like she could walk.
Correct. And also, if there were at least 10 to 12 other individuals who were speaking to her, that would indicate that she could speak, correct?
She could probably speak, but not enunciate well.
Okay. However, if there were 10 to 12 individuals who heard her say certain things, you would agree that that's probably what she said?
Possibly. But I think during those time frames, it's very difficult to understand some of the things these people say. Because we have these type of patients that come in just immediately, not 2 or 3 hours down the road. And it's very hard to understand what they say.
Dr. Hickerson said that since he wasn't on the scene, he couldn't say for certain whether Jessica made certain statements or not. Investigators with the Panola County Sheriff's Department took the stand next to testify about the investigation into Jessica's death and how they were ultimately led to Quinton Tellis. Major Barry Thompson said he retrieved Jessica's phone records, and although they investigated anyone who had contact with Jessica in the days leading up to her death, they definitely focused on the name Eric or Derek. He said they had help from the FBI, the Mississippi Bureau of Investigations, or MBI, the ATF, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the U.S. Marshals, to look into any Erics or Dereks in the area. He said they interviewed more than 15 of them, but all were eliminated as suspects. And in addition to the Eric and Derek search, they conducted interviews with everyone who had been in contact with Jessica. And 6 days after the murder, they interviewed Quinton Tellis for the first time. Quinton told them how he met Jessica. He said he met her through Keisha Myers, and said that he and Jessica would talk and text a lot. When the three of them would hang out, they would often ride around and smoke dope. When asked if they had an intimate relationship, he said no, but he then said that they had had sex one time. When asked where he was at the time of the crime, Quinton said he was in the area of Cortland, known as the Sandbox. He said he was with two friends, Michael and Terrence, also known as Big Mike and Tootie. Quinton gave them a voluntary DNA sample and told them that he believed a man named Derek Holmes had been stalking Jessica. Major Thompson said they continued on with their investigation and looked into Derek Holmes, but said he wasn't a viable suspect. An expert in fire debris analysis testified that burnt clothing from the scene tested positive for gasoline. The state's next witness was a special agent with the MBI named Tim Douglas. Agent Douglas testified about the investigation, the interviews he conducted with Quinton Tellis, and the timeline of Jessica's disappearance, according to both hers and Quinton's cell phone locations. As for the investigation, he said he got a warrant for Jessica's phone records and used them to get an initial list of suspects going. He said two people Jessica had been in contact with on the day she died were Keisha and Quentin. They contacted Keisha first, and she told them about Quentin and how they had hung out that day. Agent Douglas said that Quentin was just someone to interview at that point, not even a person of interest. In the first interview they conducted with Quentin, Quentin initially said that he only saw her in the morning, but then he said she texted him after that and asked him for some money. He said after lunch he walked across the road to the M&M convenience store and threw money in her car, and that that was the last time he saw her. He told investigators that he couldn't hang out with her anymore that day because one of his girlfriends had been over. Agent Douglas said he was advised that the firefighters believed that Jessica had said the name Eric or Derek, which he considered to be the first clue in the investigation. But at the same time, he said seeing the shape that Jessica was in, he thought maybe she couldn't say what she meant. So they didn't just limit their investigation to Eric's and Derek's. But they did get information for every Eric and Derek in Panola County, which is how they started their investigation on that Monday after Jessica's death. Douglas stated that they thought they were close to solving the case multiple times. They took DNA samples from multiple people, analyzed more than 1,000 phone records, and conducted well over 100 interviews. On December 29, 2014, he said he went to Des Moines, Iowa for what they thought was a viable lead, but they were able to eliminate it. They also spent several days in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and, quote, ran that lead dry too. And meanwhile, people were continuously calling in tips. Tips saying that, quote, maybe one of the parents did it, relaying rumors that were heard, and even psychics. You can't imagine some of the foolishness of the tips we received, he said. And they ran down every lead they had, including the Eric or Derek lead. He said over 10 men named Eric or Derek were looked into. One man in particular, they spent several days looking into, interviewing him, his family, and his friends. He had had contact with Jessica, but they were able to 100% eliminate him, saying that he was at home rubbing his mom's feet at the time of the murder. Agent Douglas said that finally, in September 2015, they decided to go back and start over. And after reinvestigating his phone records, they decided to look more into Quentin. He had said that the last time he saw Jessica was at the M&M store after lunch on December 6th, but his phone records showed differently. In November 2015, they decided to re-interview him. By this time, he had moved to Monroe, Louisiana, so Agent Douglas and Agent Paul Meadows went out there to talk to him. Their interview was played in court for the jury. In this interview, Quentin elaborated on the one time he said he and Jessica had had sex. He said they had done it in the driveway just south of his house. They were in her car, and she crawled on top of him in the passenger seat. He again said that the last time he saw Jessica was when he gave her money to go get something to eat while she was at M&M across the street from his house around lunchtime on the day she died. He said he couldn't hang out with her because one of his girlfriends, Jamie Shaw, was over. He said he talked to Jessica later on that day and that she had wanted to meet up with him again, but he told her that he couldn't because his other girlfriend, Shakita, was coming up from Louisiana. Agent Douglas testified about the inconsistencies they started noticing while they were interviewing him.
Now, initially, he indicated that Jamie Shaw was with him all day. Is that correct?
He did. And we had actually already talked to Jamie Shaw before we went to Louisiana. And it'll be the first of what I call, I don't know if you call it, it'll be the first of what I call the wait a minute or the uh-oh moments. You'll see several as this interview progresses. Mr. Tellis will indicate, I was with so-and-so, we were doing such-and-such. And Meadows are obviously, well, wait a minute. Quentin, it's up. Oh, wait a minute, or uh-oh, and so he would change. Agent Meadows even brought out the fact. He said, "Quentin, you and I both know you weren't with Jamie." He said, "Yes, that's right." Oh, you talking about that day? Yes, you're right.
When y'all had been talking about that day all along.
That's correct, sir.
Okay.
Agent Douglas said that Quentin was adamant that he didn't see Jessica later that day, even raising his hand at one point and saying, "On my mama, I did not see her after I gave her that money." But the agents had surveillance video of Jessica pulling into the M&M store at 5:24 p.m. on the day she disappeared, not around lunchtime, like Quentin had claimed. They showed him the footage, and Quentin said, "That's when I gave her money." And they said, "No, Quentin, you didn't give her any money that day." Because where Quentin claimed he gave her the money would have been caught on camera, and it wasn't. Agent Douglas told the jury that when they would show Quentin evidence in the form of surveillance video or phone records, he would then adjust his story until finally he admitted to seeing Jessica that night.
He was confronted with irrefutable evidence. And when I say evidence, irrefutable facts. The fact of the video. Well, Paul hit it over and over. We see Jessica. We see your phone. We see you call her. We see Jessica call you. We see the video. We don't see you walk over. Paul goes into great detail. And when Paul, so I know you couldn't see it, when Paul's sitting there with his computer, he's actually flipping screens. He's hitting that button and the screens are flipping. And he's saying, "Okay, Quint, cell towers say this." And in my own ignorant technological way, I try to explain to Quentin about these cell towers and how they triangulate and pinpoint what your location. And Paul's hitting those buttons saying, but the evidence says you're here. And the video shows this, and the evidence says you're here. That's when Mr. Tellis began to change his story to match what we knew. I believe Agent Meadows said early on, "We're not going to show you ahead of time what we have. We just want you to know we have it." And I think you'll notice also, and hopefully appreciate, we were not being confrontational with Quentin. It was a simple look, man. We didn't come down here to argue. We came down here with facts. All we want to know is the truth.
And eventually, he began to tell his version of the truth according to what you showed him.
His version of the truth at the time, yes, sir. Okay.
Douglas said that Quentin's version of the truth was that he left the sandbox at some point that afternoon, borrowed his friend Big Mike's car, and met Jessica at the Taco Bell in Batesville. He said Jessica ordered something to eat along with a slush. This was after the agents showed him the cell phone data, showing their phones were on top of each other during this time. Prosecutor Champion pointed out that Quentin at first couldn't remember even being with Jessica at that time, yet was then able to recall what she ate and drank. Quentin then told the agents that that was actually the last time he had seen Jessica. He said Jessica called him again later, and he told her that he couldn't see her again that night because his girlfriend Shakita was coming into town. But, as Agent Douglas told the jury, there was nothing in his phone records that showed this. In fact, according to the phone records, the last call Jessica made to Quentin was at 5:29 p.m. when she was seen leaving the M&M convenience store. Agent Douglas testified that he told Quentin that he was either the second-to-last person to ever talk to Jessica or the last person, meaning he was the killer. He said he paused after saying this, but that Quentin never corrected him. In January 2016, Agent Douglas said they interviewed Quentin again. This time, they had interviewed Big Mike, Quentin's friend, who he had said he had borrowed the car from to meet up with Jessica at Taco Bell. Big Mike had told them that he had actually gone out of town that day to Nashville and that Quentin had never borrowed his car. When confronted with that, Quentin admitted that he hadn't borrowed Big Mike's car and that Jessica had come to pick him up that night. He said they went to Taco Bell together and then drove back and parked at his house. On cross-examination, Agent Douglas was asked how he was able to eliminate the Erics and Derricks in the investigation. For example, the guy named Derek Holmes, who Quentin said had been stalking Jessica. Douglas said Derek Holmes didn't have any contact with Jessica on December 6th. When asked about the guy in Des Moines, Iowa, that they had gone to interview, Agent Douglas admitted that no DNA testing had been done on him, but that there was, quote, no need to. He said they were suspicious of him at first because he had left town in a hurry, but it turned out he had been involved in a separate shooting and didn't even know Jessica Chambers. When asked why they collected certain people's DNA and not others, Douglas said they obtained it from people who had been in recent contact with Jessica, but admitted that there was no written down method. He said only about 5 to 10 people's DNA was tested. Quentin's attorney asked about Glenn Williams and his friend Troy, the two guys who had come across the car fire that night and had called the fire department. Douglas said there was no need to test them because they didn't have any contact with Jessica. Quinton's attorney then pointed out inconsistencies in Glenn's testimony. He had testified that flames had reached up into the trees and that he had gotten out of his car, but Agent Douglas admitted that Glenn had never told him that. Douglas testified that he interviewed close to 10 Erics and Derricks himself, but none of whom were tested. Perhaps the state's biggest witness was a man named James Paul Rylette, who analyzed the phone dump from Jessica's phone. He gave the court a presentation, which included a full detailed timeline of events the day that Jessica was killed. He said he used the content from Jessica's phone, the location data from Jessica and Quinton's phones, and surveillance video and witness testimony to put the timeline together. Before going into the timeline, he talked about the dump from Jessica's phone. Looking at her outgoing calls and text messages, they were able to figure out everyone she had talked to within 30 days of the murder. He said there were no Erics or Derricks in that analysis. She did not talk to anyone with those names in those 30 days. They did find two Erics who were Facebook friends of hers out of 100 Facebook friends in her phone, but neither one had any contact with Jessica. In addition to looking at Jessica's phone, they looked at Keisha Meyer's phone too to see if she had any Erics or Derricks in her life. He said they analyzed all of them too and excluded every one of them, including Derrick Holmes. Rylette said he wasn't in Jessica's phone, they weren't Facebook friends, and that he lived on the other side of Cortland with no transportation. He said Derrick Holmes was eliminated as a suspect. For the day of the murder, Rylette told the court that he looked at times where he knew exactly where Jessica was, using surveillance photos, for example. He then compared it to the phone location data to see how accurate the phone company's info was. He said he found that the estimation by the cell phone towers was off by about a half mile to the east. He was then able to shift what the cell phone company data said, that exact same distance, to match where they actually knew where Jessica was. And they then used that formula to determine where her phone was throughout the day and night. He said they then compared this revised data to Quinton Tellis's phone, and using that, along with Jessica's phone records, content of Jessica's text messages for the prior 7 days, interviews with Quinton, and surveillance video from M&M, they were able to construct a complete timeline of events. Rylette noted that they only had the contents of Jessica's phone and not from Quinton's, because Quinton had deleted all of his phone calls and text messages to and from Jessica after her murder. Rylette started his timeline presentation by saying that Jessica and Quinton had only known each other for 2 to 3 weeks. In the days leading up to the murder, Quinton and Jessica exchanged text messages. In the 4 days prior, on Wednesday, December 3rd, 2014, their text exchange read like this. Quinton, I'm horny. Jessica, oh Lord. Quinton, can I have some? Come lay with me. Jessica, you're at home, LOL. Your sister and your mom are there. They would freak out if they see me. Jessica then tells him she's tired and says goodnight. The next day, on Thursday, December 4th, Quinton texts, I'm horny. And Jessica responds, oh Lord. On Friday, December 5th, another reference for sex. Jessica texts Quinton and asks for money so she can eat. Quinton responds, can I eat you? Jessica puts him off, and they talk about how much money she needs. She says, just like six. Surveillance video then shows Quinton walking over to her car in the M&M parking lot and then walking back home. Rylette said that this was the day that Quinton loaned money to Jessica and dropped it off at her car across the street. On the day of the murder, December 6, 2014, from 12:32 a.m. to 10:04 a.m., every call Quinton makes goes through the Polk Tower, which is his home tower. It covers the area of the M&M store and his home, as well as other areas throughout Cortland. In the morning, surveillance video shows Quinton walking across the street and going into the M&M store. Around 9 a.m., Jessica texts him and says, I just woke up. Quinton responds with, Same, me too. At 9:06 a.m., surveillance video shows a white Suburban driven by Quentin's mom pulling out of the Tellis home driveway. At 10:04 a.m., Jessica calls Quentin. At 10:08 a.m., surveillance video shows her pulling into the M&M convenience store. At 10:09 a.m., Quentin texts her, "I'm ready." And at 10:13, Jessica can be seen leaving M&M and picking up Quentin. From 10:15 through 10:47 a.m., Jessica and Quentin then pick up Keisha Myers, and they go riding around, smoking marijuana. Quentin says in one of his interviews that at one point, they drove out to where the crime scene ended up and turned around. At 10:47 a.m., Quentin places a call to one of his sisters, and his cell phone data shows that he is getting close to home. At 10:48, his phone switches back to his home tower, and surveillance video shows Jessica dropping him off at 10:49. At 10:55, after Jessica drops Quentin off, he walks over to M&M. He's wearing black shoes, dark jeans, a red shirt, a dark plaid red jacket, and a red hat. Based on her cell phone data, Jessica then heads home. All calls she places from 11:05 through 5:29 p.m. are from her home tower. Jessica's mom says she took a nap during this time period, and about 20 minutes prior to her nap, Quentin texts her, "I need you, bae," and says he wants some loving. This is the fourth time in 4 days that he has asked for sex in a text message, Prosecutor Champion points out. Jessica responds, "Oh Lord, can't." Between 3:24 p.m. and 4:15 p.m., Quentin exchanges text messages with someone he calls his girlfriend, Shakita Jackson. Shakita lives in Monroe, Louisiana. She tells him she wants to come to Cortland, and she wants him to send her money so she can come. There's no activity on Jessica's phone from 2:21 to 4:23. At 4:23, Quentin calls Jessica. Jessica's mom later told police that Jessica had woken up to someone calling her and that that led to her leaving the house. Jessica then starts trying to contact Keisha. She calls and texts her 13 times over the next couple hours. We know later from interviews that Jessica had been planning to take Keisha out for her birthday. At 4:32 p.m., Jessica and Quentin text again. Jessica says if he will buy them something to eat, she will go get it. From 4:40 to 5:14, Jessica texts Keisha again and then texts Quentin, "Where are you at?" At 4:59 p.m., she calls him. About 9 minutes later, surveillance video shows Quentin walking to the M&M store. He paces around but doesn't buy anything. He appears to be looking around. He leaves at 5:12. About 8 minutes later, at 5:20, he calls Jessica, and then she calls him back. At 5:24, Jessica is seen on surveillance video, arriving at M&M. At 5:29, Jessica calls Quentin just before she pulls out, but gets his voicemail. She can be seen on surveillance video at the store and can then be seen leaving. At 5:34, Quentin calls Jessica. This is his last call or text out until 6:17 p.m. In his final police interview in January, Quentin admitted that Jessica picked him up around this time at his house. Rylett points out that surveillance video, however, does not show Jessica picking him up from his home. That white Suburban, Quentin's mom's car, is in the driveway at this point. Rylett points out that in her text messages, Jessica had said if Quentin's mom saw her, she would freak out, so she probably wouldn't pull into the driveway, Rylett said. Based on his statements and the phone records, Rylett said that you can tell that Quentin and Jessica are now together at this point. They make their way into Batesville, where the Taco Bell is. At 6:10 p.m., Jessica tries again to reach Keisha. At 6:17, Quentin's phone call makes a call to one of his sisters. His phone location shows that he's in Batesville when he makes this call. At 6:22 and 6:25, Jessica tries to reach Keisha again, and Rylett says that you can see her phone head further south, coming back into Cortland. Jessica and Quentin get back into Cortland at around 6:30, according to cell tower data, along with what Quentin said in his interview. In his interview, Quinton told the agents that they went back to his house and smoked marijuana for 30 minutes while sitting in Jessica's car. But Rylette says the surveillance video, however, does not show this, and that white Suburban is still there in the driveway. In one of his interviews, Quinton told the agents that he had previously had sex with Jessica in that drive just south of his house, an area that is not within surveillance view. Rylette says that due to Quinton's statements and Jessica's cell phone data, we know that they are in this area at this time. The last call that Jessica ever makes was at 6:41 p.m. when she again tries to call Keisha. From 6:49 to 7:26, there is no activity from neither Jessica's phone nor Quinton's. Rylette stops the timeline here to drive home a point about something Quinton had said in his interviews. He admitted to having sex with Jessica on a prior date in that drive south of his home. He said that they had sex in the passenger seat with the seat leaned back and her on top. Rylette points out that when Jessica's burning car was discovered, the passenger seat was reclined. He notes that Jessica had been found in her panties and that Quinton had asked her for sex earlier that day. In his interview, Quinton stated that they did not have sex the night she died because she was on her period. But as you'll recall, the medical examiner testified earlier in the trial that there was no evidence that she had been on her period that night. After making those points to the jury, Rylette got back into the timeline. He said that between 6:55 and 7:18 p.m., there were five different girls trying to get in touch with Quinton. All calls went to his voicemail. A text from Shakita, who had told him earlier that she wanted money so she could come to Cortland, reads, "Oh well." In Quinton's final interview with the agents, he said he left Jessica at 7 p.m., but surveillance video does not support this. Instead, at 7:26 p.m., headlights can be seen pulling out from that drive just south of the Tellis home. And then Jessica arrives at the crime scene at 7:30 p.m. The timeline picks up again at 7:42, with Quinton making some outgoing calls. He calls Jessica's phone first and then sends her a text that says, "Bae, my friend is coming over tonight. I'll call you tomorrow. Good night, sweet dreams." Rylette points out that in Quinton's interview, he said he was walking to his sister's house at this point to get his sister's car, at first saying that his friend Jamie Shaw was coming over. But in the interview, they ask him if Jamie will confirm his story, and he then says no, that it was actually Shakita who was coming later that night. He calls Shakita back at 7:46, after he text messages Jessica. He says he's walking to get his sister's car. Rylette tells the jury that when you walk from the crime scene to Quinton's sister's house, which is about a mile away, you would walk past the area where Jessica's keys were later found. Quinton's phone was not in use from 7:46 to 8 p.m. At 7:50, video surveillance shows a vehicle pulling into the Tellis driveway. It sits there for over a minute and then backs back up. Rylette told the jury that there's a shed right there and that according to Quinton in one of his interviews with agents, he said he keeps a 5-gallon gas can in there. The headlights then head south at 7:52 p.m. in the direction of the crime scene. At 8 p.m., Quinton calls Shakita. His cell phone hits off the tower in Cortland. At 8:04, the last communication between Jessica's phone and any other phone was recorded, meaning that her phone had died. Rylette points out that the phone could have run out of batteries, could have been turned off, or the heat could have made it shut off. He reminded the jury that her phone was about 2 to 3 feet from the car, exposing it to an extreme amount of heat. At 8:08 p.m., Quinton can be seen passing the M&M store, traveling to Batesville to buy a prepaid card. When they showed him the surveillance video in the interview, Quinton said that was probably him. At 8:06, the first call was made to the fire department about the fire. At 8:26, Quinton can be seen on surveillance video at a store called Fred's. He's wearing the same clothes he had been wearing earlier, minus his coat, even though it was colder outside at night. When asked about this in his interview, Quinton said he must have forgotten it. Quinton purchases the prepaid card at Fred's. He then sends it to Shakita, and at 9:53 p.m., she retrieves the cash from it. But Rylett told the jury that Chiquita never came down that night, that she was about 5 hours away, meaning that if she had, she wouldn't have made it down until about 2 a.m. Prosecutor Champion points out that, remember, this was the reason Quinton said he texted Jessica that he couldn't see her that night, because Chiquita was coming to town. Rylett said that at 8:57 p.m., Quinton walks over to the M&M store and buys two drinks. Surveillance video shows him wearing completely different clothes at this point, a gray plaid coat, a white t-shirt, and dark pants. Surveillance video shows that while Quinton is there, a man comes in and is very animated, talking to the cashier about something and pointing in the direction of the crime scene. In his interview, Quinton said he learned about what happened to Jessica while there at M&M. In the video, as the man is talking, Quinton opens his drink and sips from it, watching the man. He hangs around for a bit, watching, before he leaves.
Did you ask Quinton Tellis, when he found out Jessica Chambers had been injured or burned at the store, who he tried to call?
He says he thought he tried to call Jessica.
And do the phone records from either phone support that information?
They do not. He, after that 7:43 text to Jessica, he never attempted to contact her again.
And this is the same girl that he'd been hanging out with and texting with?
Correct.
And Jessica Chambers, the same girl that he claims he had sex with?
Correct.
And this is the same person that he sent that text to. My friend's coming up. We know where she is. Good night, sweet dreams.
It is.
He finds out she's been injured or burned. How many phone calls or texts does he make to Jessica to check on her?
None.
In fact, what does he do?
He tells us that sometime after that, he deletes and erases all of the calls and texts that he had with Jessica.
And he erased her from his life.
Correct.
When it was the defense's turn to put on their case, they decided they didn't have to, saying that the state had not proven theirs. They instead asked the judge for a directed verdict of not guilty, but the judge denied that request. The jury deliberated for about 9 hours, and when they announced that they had reached their verdict, everyone gathered back in the courtroom to hear the announcement. Not guilty. But after the jury was polled, per the prosecution's request, it was found that not everyone on the jury agreed with that verdict. In fact, at least 7 of the jurors, by my count, said that they actually believed the opposite, that Quinton Tellis was guilty. It turns out the jury misunderstood the jury instructions, which said that a guilty verdict had to be unanimous, but didn't say that about a not guilty verdict. So it appears as though the jurors thought that since they couldn't unanimously decide that he was guilty, that meant that the verdict had to be not guilty. The judge clarified their instructions and told them that they must be unanimous in whichever decision they make. But even after a few additional hours of deliberation, the jury couldn't agree, and a mistrial was declared. Prosecutor Champion told reporters that they will definitely retry the case against Quinton and that they are confident their case is, quote, rock solid. He said they may add the testimony of a speech therapist to their case, but that they'll decide that within the next few months. And remember how I told you earlier in the episode that Quinton was also accused of murdering a foreign exchange student in Louisiana? He's still on the hook for that one, too. Authorities in Louisiana were waiting for him to be tried in Jessica's case first. And that's all for today's episode. I would love to know what you think. Do you think there was enough evidence against Quinton Tellis and Jessica's murder? Or do you believe that someone named Eric or Derek had something to do with it? And does the fact that Quinton was charged with another murder affect your beliefs? Let me know by joining our Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I love having great advertisers support the show, but in order to continue doing that, I need your help. So please do me a favor and go to podcastlistener.com/CJ to answer a few short questions. It would be really helpful to me and for the show. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/CJ, and I'll put this in the show notes as well. And if you'd like to hear these episodes earlier than everyone else and get them ad-free, you can donate as little as $1 a month to this podcast at courtjunkie.com/support. That will give you an exclusive podcast feed to the episodes, early and ad-free. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.